lecture on Susan Jain's book on Spinoza. For today is our own Dimitris Varoulakis.
Thanks to both speakers for participating in this workshop, and also thanks to Professor James for agreeing to be present and being subjected to this experience. I would like to start with a sort of personal anecdote. I received the book in the mail in the midst of the semester, and I didn't really have time to open it. So at the end of last semester, we went to Europe, and I took the book with me and I started reading it in Europe, and as I was telling Professor James last week, it was very frustrating reading it in Europe. And the reason was that every chapter I would read, I would really want to go back to the book, to the treatise, to Spinoza's Theologica Politica treatise, to reread it. But yet I didn't have the book with me because we were traveling. So the point I want to make by this frustration that I was feeling was that Professor James's book makes it impossible for us, first, not to reread the Tractatus de Lego Politicus, and secondly, it, in a sense, impossible to read the Tractatus de Lego Politicus in the same way again. I think it's a really important book, precisely because it gives us such a different way, such a different contextualization of the whole argument, that it's just an absolutely crucial book for understanding the theologico-political treatise. I agree with Michael that the main feature of the book is that it no longer reads a sort of hidden subcontext in the book that is there not to disguise Spinoza's atheism, but rather Spinoza engages in a series of polemics with particular proponents of religion. So the main opponent is not religion as such, but, you know, Calvinism and so on and so forth. And thanks, Michael. I'm not as thorough as you. I couldn't find the footnote. I knew the argument was, you know, was all over the book. But I was actually trying to find a single sentence to encapsulate, and I didn't notice footnote 72 yesterday when I was, you know, writing these notes. You know, but I agree that that's in a sense the, you know, obvious overarching point of the book. You know, and just to state the obvious for anyone who's just opened the book, the erudition is absolutely amazing, and the thorough consideration and close readings of the text is breathtaking, and the innovation is astounding. So, you know, I wholeheartedly recommend the book to anyone. I think it's essential to anyone who wants to study the theologico-political treatise. And having, you know, piled all this praise on the book, I really found myself really not knowing what to say about the book, given that I really liked it so much. You know, it's a bit, you know, if you've seen a movie that you really like, if you don't have any criticism, if you just provide a summary, you know, you either bore to death all those who've already seen the movie, or you spoil it for those who haven't seen it. So I was in a bit of a double bind, right? So I thought, instead of kind of trying to engage with the whole book, I thought, let's just go to the premise upon which the book is based, and just look, let's just look at the premise, you know. So I'm not going beyond page 4, right? So I'll just look at the premise. Okay, so the premise is articulated on page 4. In the case of the treatise, where Spinoza argues furiously against a sequence of theological and political opponents, philosophy is not so much a conversation as a struggle, a fight against deeply entrenched outlook over issues that both sides regard as utterly fundamental. So this is a description of what philosophy does, of what the Tractatus de Lego Politicus does. The treatise is a polemic, a book written under the sign of opposition, almost said under the sign of insurrection, against a series of particular contemporary adversaries. And Professor James continues. Because Spinoza is not only advocating a position of his own, but trying to persuade his readers that his opponent's views are irretrievably flawed, the treatise is shaped by the oppositions it is contesting. The treatise is shaped by the oppositions it is contesting. To vindicate his program, Spinoza has to discredit the theological and political positions that stand in his way. In order to appreciate both what he is saying and why he is saying it, one needs to understand the views he is attacking. So here we see the method adopted by the book, you know, disclosing the context, disclosing, you know, who is he attacking in every particular chapter, in every particular sentence, right? For 17th century readers familiar with the milieu in which the treatise was written and the debates in which it intervened, this would have been relatively straightforward, but it's much more difficult for us. You know, it is this difficulty that sets the task of the book. So here we have a justification of the method adopted from the book, reading the treatise by discovering the positions, by disclosing the positions it contests, which I believe is an original methodological approach to the treatise and largely responsible for the book's huge significance for Spinoza scholarship. Now, the question I want to ask is, let's pose a hypothesis. Let's, you know, assume that, let's accept both the premise, the polemical nature of the treatise, and the method that we need to disclose these polemics in order to understand the treatise. But let's assume in addition one more premise, that the method of the Tractatus Theologico-Politicus, the polemic in which it engages, itself has this in common with the method of the ethics, namely, that method and argument mirror each other. This is a very well-known point about the ethics, of course. It is well-known that the geometric method of the ethics is meant to mirror the argument of the ethics, you know? So can we possibly hypothesize for a moment that the polemic nature of the treatise is not only a method employed by Spinoza, but also discloses something about his argument, what he says about politics and about political freedom, has as a constitutive element the notion of the polemic. What will happen then? And here, you know, this extra premise is a premise that Professor James does not employ. And I want to employ it very quickly here and kind of see the effects that are produced by adding this this extra premise. Okay, so I've listed here very quickly three effects. Okay, and I'll have references to the book very quickly. So, firstly, the first effect is that agonism, or the agonistic element, is central to the political. Now, this is not an outlandish claim. This claim can be discovered in a very early political text. The reference that I like to use to say that the agonism, the polemic, is not is absolutely crucial, constitutive of the political, is this weird sentence which is contained in paragraph 8 of the Athenian Constitution, which is attributed to Aristotle. My students know all about this sentence because I constantly quote it. Now, that sentence occurs in the discussion of the institutions of Athens as they were developed by Solon, the first author of a democratic constitution. And after we have a discussion of different laws and so on and so forth, he arrives at the discussion of the Areopagos, the constitutional court, so to speak, of Athens, and then this sentence suddenly appears. And as he, Solon, saw that the polis was often in a condition of conflict, stasiazusan, internal arrest, argument, you know, while some of its citizens, through slackness, were content to let things slide, he laid down a special law to deal with them, enacting that whoever, when the city was in conflict, when there was a polemic, did not join forces with either party, was to be disenfranchised, to be thrown out of the city, and not to be a member of the state. So what, in a sense, this notion of the polemic means doesn't mean that, you know, politics needs to be, you know, about argument for the sheer of argument, for the sake of argument, but rather that, you know, what politics requires is engagement. You are not elected to be a member of the community. You're not be elected to be a member of either religious or political community. And here I call the arguments against election in the Tractatus de Laico Politicus. Rather, you need to engage in some ways in order to become a member of the community. Okay, the second point. I think if we accept that agonism and the polemic are central to the political, this has repercussions of how we think about the law and legality. In particular, and this is a point that has echoes of the way that the substance is conceived in the ethics, we can think that there is nothing outside the law. Let me explain what I mean by that. The concept of the law is, from this perspective, understood as a product of opposition or contestation. The law is neither simply positive law, nor simply natural law, that is, it is neither reduced to the written law, nor simply seeking legitimation from some kind of source, state of nature or whatever. We can see here the centrality of ethics in defining the natural law that Professor James astutely observes in page 91. What distinguishes the law from its civil counterpart is not that it is made by the deity, but rather the nature of its goal. While the civil law aims at security, the aim of divine law is to realize our highest good, which consists in the knowledge and love of God. So there's something, the law here escapes, in a sense, the bounds of the state and achieves an ethical significance that makes it spread. It gives it a kind of an expansive meaning. So I would like to add a couple of corollaries to this position. First, we need to take seriously the proposition that there is nothing outside the law if we think the law as this enactment of agonism and contestation that it becomes, in a sense, the precondition of the political. If there is, if engagement is that which produces the political, so long as there is engagement, and there is engagement when there are two people, you know, there is some form of legality. Maybe it's not constituted law, but, you know, it's attributable to a kind of ethical source and then divine law. It also means, and that's the second corollary, it also means that particular expressions of the laws, modes of the divine law, so to speak, in inverted commas, are not to be dismissed as merely flawed, but rather as necessary within a particular context of being. If they do not lead to knowledge and love of God, then these legal articulations at least lead to authority and obedience, and they signify, according to the treatise, the presence of a community, that is, the fact that is that one is within the law. Okay, let me clarify what I'm suggesting here. We can identify a concept of the law that is so expansive that covers every aspect of human interaction, every aspect of human engagement, every aspect of the political in that sense, even if the absence of it's been written down, and even in the absence of any foundation in a pre-political state. Let me give you a couple of examples about, or three examples actually, what I mean by it. Here we're in a room, and there is a whole series of conventions about how we conduct themselves. For instance, it will be a convention that we can engage polemically in arguments. But if someone's speaking, a member of the audience wouldn't be, rolling their eyes and yawning and making expansive gestures to show their displeasure with the argument. Why? Because this is not a real engagement with the argument. This is an ad hominem dismissal of the person make the arguments. We see here how engagement then institutes certain rules and regulations, certain modes of being with, and that is the notion of the expansive law that I want to articulate here. Another example is there's this little book, which is a conversation between Spivak and Judith Butler, and there is this it's just a wonderful moment in the exchange when they're talking about the notion of homo sacer, Agamben's homo sacer, the figure that is outside the law, in Guantanamo Bay. And suddenly they find themselves agreeing and say, but how can they possibly say that, the people incarcerated in Guantanamo Bay are outside the law? They're subject to so many rules and regulations there. It's absurd to say that, these figures are outside the law. That's a second example. And the third example, specifically from the treaties, is the example of the Hebrew, of the Jewish people leaving Egypt, the Exodus. I disagree with Professor James that the Exodus from Egypt, I'm correcting from 271, put the Israelites back into a state of nature. It seems to me, rather, that the point Spinoza is making is that during the Exodus, the Jews were acting under the authority of Moses, in which case the story of the creation of the Jewish state is the story of the transition between different forms of legality, from the authority of Moses to the divine authority of the Ten Commandments to the authority of the organized Jewish state. But there is no state of nature that is outside the law in Spinoza. We can read the whole narrative of the treaties as the whole narrative of the Mosaic state in the treaties precisely as making that point. The Jews, from the moment they leave Egypt, are under some form of authority. So long as they're under some form of authority, some form of convention regulation, they're under some form of legality. So that was the second point with various implications. There is nothing outside the law. Third, and here we move to how right is to be understood. Usually, right is understood in opposition to law. But if law has this expansive meaning, maybe a different way of understanding right is possible in Spinoza. And I would suggest that right needs to be understood in terms of power. Spinoza says in chapter 16 that we must not confuse the state of nature with the state of religion, but must conceive it as a being without religion or law, and hence without sin or violation of right, which is a passage quoted by Professor James on page 238. Now, if we take the above position seriously, that is the centrality of agonism and the polemic and the fact that there is nothing outside the law, then the passage cannot, no matter how much it is stretched, square with the Hobbesian conception of the state of nature. According to Hobbes, the state of nature is characterized an individualistic state. People are allowed to desire whatever, they have the freedom to desire whatever they want, and that's what leads to a war of all against all. Secondly, it is pre-political and hence associated with the freedom of rights. Thirdly, it is opposed to law. One has to reject one's rights, so transfer, that's the word rather, one's rights to the sovereign in order to have the creation of the state. Whereas these elements are not present in Spinoza. Now, the use of the term state of nature is very different in Spinoza. In fact, it seems to me that Hobbes is one of the, if not the, main adversary against whom Spinoza's argument develops from chapter 16 of the Tractatus de Logica Politicus onwards. For instance, in chapter 17, Spinoza explains that after the Exodus, the Jews, finding themselves thus placed in this state of nature, they hearken to Moses, in whom they placed the greatest confidence. He is their authority. And resolve to transfer the right not to any mortal man, but to God, the creation of the theocracy. The idea then that both a temporal authority, Moses, and a sovereign God to whom right is transferred in the state of nature is something. This idea that you have a state of nature where you have these two notions of legality seems to me completely incompatible with Hobbes's position, where the state of nature is something pre-political, right? Something individualistic. I'm fully aware of the irony of talking about Hobbes and for Professor Skinner, but anyway, thus I'm trying to qualify Professor James' statement that without dwelling on his horrors, Spinoza shares Hobbes' view that the state of nature contains no legal standard of private civil right. I agree that the state of nature does not contain civil rights, since these need the support of state law. But the state of nature is not a place of horrors like Hobbes' state of nature, because there is authority, Moses or God, a theocracy, and hence a sense of legality. I'm saying all this in order to argue that it's possible to read Spinoza not as deriving the notion of right in relation to the concept of the state law, in opposition or whatever. Rather, right is understood in relation to power, as he puts it at the beginning of chapter 16. Not only for nature, right is coextensive with her power, but also the right of the individual is coextensive with his determinate power. So unless we take the connection between right and power seriously, it seems to me very difficult to account for what Spinoza says immediately following the above assertions. And I'm quoting again from the treatise. And here, not acknowledging the distinction between, famous passage, between men and other individuals of nature, between men endowed with reason and others to whom true reason is unknown, nor between fools, madmen, and the same. Whatever an individual thing does by the laws of its nature, it does with sovereign right, inasmuch as it acts as determined by nature and can do no other. Now, what exactly power means in this context when it is associated with right? Well, look, I'm not sure what power means in this context, I have to say. I know that we need to turn to the ethics in order to help us articulate this question, but it seems to me that, in a sense, this is a secondary concern. The main point that I want to raise is that, unlike Hobbes, where right, in a sense, needs to be defined in some kind of relation to the law, disjunctive relation, or, you know, a sense of transfer or whatever, here, right can be defined without recourse to the law in Spinoza, with recourse to power. And that seems to me an important implication that follows from the other two positions. So let me summarize. If we accept the method outlined by Professor James, namely that the treatise is a polemic and that we need to understand the treatise in terms of the polemics in which Spinoza engages specifically, is it possible to add a third premise here, namely that the method of the treatise and the argument of the treatise kind of mirror each other, very much in the way that the ethics pursues this argument. And then I think three implications follow, to repeat: the centrality of agonism for the articulation of the political, for the understanding of the political and for human relations, for being with, the fact that there is no outside the law, and the fact that right is determined in relation to power. One final word in lieu of a provisional conclusion. It is not accidental that I referred to Solon and the Athenian constitution, the author of the first democratic constitution, in order to define agonism. Agonism reinforces Spinoza's democratic credentials. From this perspective, Spinoza must surely rank as one of Spinoza's adversaries. Thank you.